Rod, welcome to the podcast.
Great to be here, Jake.
Thank you so much for joining today. I've got a long list of questions for you, Rod. First of all, just want to highlight how cool it is that you get different touch points with different people, whether it's online to start with or maybe a physical interaction. And then, okay, we've got to do a podcast. And that's the case with you and I today. So very excited for this conversation. First question for you, Rod, is the Noster network, like, why does it exist? Why are you even using it? And let's spend lots of time talking about that because I'm super excited about it as well. But you're building on Noster, and I'd love to dig into, like, you know, your process to getting to today.
Yeah, great, Jake. I mean, I'm a big Noster fan. If it's okay, I'll just give a bit of background in terms of who I am and how I ended up here.
Absolutely, please.
Kind of explain it all. So my background, I started a technology company about January 2012. I grew that up for 6 years to listed on the ASX. In January 2018, I then ran that for 6 years as a public list co. And, you know, then I stepped aside and new management have taken it forward and they're doing their own things. But the, you know, that journey of raising and building technology over a number of years taught just so much, right? Mm. I mean, we were, you know, I guess 2012. So, you know, a good period in the middle of that free money era that I think Bitcoiners who know about monetary policy will know what zero interest rates does to venture, for example. Mm-hmm. You know, we started at a good period there where capital was available, where we were able to grow something really quickly, and we did so. And then, you know, we were able to I guess, be successful at that, right? Early investors invested, you know, at a $1 million pre-money, and IPO was at $40 million. We were Australia's first ever equity crowdfunding exit. You know, even then, kind of listing and running through COVID, we were able to, you know, take essentially a travel technology company through the end of travel. As far as public investors were concerned of at the time, they said, you know, this is it. And so we're there on the receiving end again of more, say, policy decisions that, no, we're not allowed to leave Australia, right? And so we can say again that maybe there are policy impacts here to running a business in a vertical. It has to be a favored vertical. But we got through, right? We reduced costs. We got through on a kind of a method that didn't involve raising stats of dilutive equity at the bottom of a kind of a valuation trough. Instead, we, you know, cut costs, but we took care of people and we got through. We made sure every supplier was paid. We came out the other side. It's a really interesting story. And so then again, on the flip side, we benefited. You know, there was a moment there in markets where if you were, you know, seeking a barbell to your, the world is ending pandemic thesis, but what if I'm wrong? Well, you really want to invest in a flyer. And so, you know, here's a travel technology startup that I can invest in. And we became, you know, able to, I guess, on the outside benefit from that, raise a large sum of money, attract some very exciting investors. We were the 10th fastest growth company in Australia that year. Just, you know, flying out of the traps. And I took the thing to, you know, bigger than it was pre-pandemic and said, wow, you know, I've done my 6 years public and we've recovered the company and it's time for me to go and explore other things. And I guess through all of that, a few things. One, learned the importance of monetary policy and fiscal policy on markets. You know, there's stories to tell about how capital works that, you know, both in terms of private market investing and also public market and accessing capital there, that it's just so dependent on the environment you're in. And then also through the pandemic learned, well, you know, what happens when suddenly narratives are completely controlled? You know, what happens when suddenly your industry is completely shut down? And started to, you know, listen to, you know, what Jack Dorsey had been through, sympathizing with him as the head of a smaller list co and saying, well, I can understand exactly the kind of pressures he was under, but then, you know, hearing, hey, there's this solution, you know, and a solution that seems reasonably resilient if you're talking about, you know, communication, resilient to different policy decisions. If you're talking about monetary policy, well, it's riding on Bitcoin, which is resilient to certain policy decisions. And we're sitting here as, you know, I've built this company from zero twice. I'm looking for my next run to be built on something resilient.
Wow.
Quite besides what AI has done, which is a whole other thing as well. But these are the things that lead me to kind of Bitcoin and to Noster. I mean, I'm super excited to unpack them all for you, but that's roughly why I'm here.
Awesome, Rod. Okay, and it's always interesting where conversations go, because today I was like, I've got so many questions for Rod about the last decade, but I was going to try and maybe weave them in later to like the Nosta story today. But let's flip it around and do exactly what you've done, because actually the chronological order is also really nice. So the business that you set up and IPO'd was called J-Ride. And you kindly shared a link yesterday, which gave some great context on like the problem, the solution that you came up with. Most of the people listening to this won't have listened to the equity investor that you were talking to. So as a founder of a business, the philosophy of build it and they will come in Satoshi, in my mind, has never been better represented. Like, he just built this thing, he, she, they, and we've ended up using it. It's built on the back of a lot of other work, which is often overlooked. But then on the flip side of that, you've got, okay, do as much customer research as you can. Maybe you came across a problem of your own, and do other people need the solution that you can create, and go and fill that need. And listening to the interview that you did yesterday, you came down more in that side of like, okay, I think there's a need for this business. And clearly there was. So take us right back to like the genesis point of like, okay, I know I want to start a company. What skills did you have? Who did you know? How did you even begin to get it off the ground?
Yeah, so it's a good question. So look, for those who don't know J-Ride, and at the time that I was running it, and it's doing something different under new management now, but at the time that I was running it, broadly speaking, it went like this. Jake, have you ever traveled?
Yes.
Yeah.
A lot. Yeah.
And so you kind of be familiar that there's a couple of important parts to travel. One is, you know, what is great to do in a location? And the other is, how on earth do I get to that place? And the travel industry is very good at selling dreams about, you know, amazing things to do. And it's very good at selling certain parts of those experiences. But it was very bad at the time that I started about actually helping you get there. You know, flight aggregation had become a thing, right? Webjet and Skyscanner, these sorts of businesses have become a thing. But what about that last mile? And you looked at travel. Travel at the time, again, that I had started this and was running this, had built a stack of really nice aggregator models, right? So you had booking.com for hotels, Webjet for flights, Skyscanner for flights, so on and so forth. But no aggregator for the last mile. This was pre-Uber even, right? You know, taxis all around the world were all completely different companies. How do you as a person actually work out how to get around? And not just work it out, how do you access it? And so we stepped into that vertical. We said, well, like as a macro kind of idea, that makes sense. As a traveler with a lived experience, I've been stuck in places and I wish I knew how to get around. You know, let's step into that with aggregator model. It made sense from a macro point of view. It made sense from a markets point of view. You know, taking a look at how Australian public equities had, you know, played out over the previous years. Australian equity investors were starting to get familiar with marketplaces, right? Because you had, you know, Seek for jobs, it's a marketplace. You know, Domain for properties, it's a marketplace. Car sales for cars, it's a marketplace. So they kind of understood marketplace dynamics, marketplace defensibility, all of these things. We said, in a macro sense, it makes sense. In an equities sense, it makes sense. Okay, let's go raise some money and let's go build a company. And so, you know, we did. But I guess the thing that is, I guess the lesson that I didn't know at the time and that I've subsequently learned, and I think this is an important lesson for all founders. See, because when you're a founder, and I think I'm probably speaking for most founders, you're starting a company because you don't actually want a job, right? You want to be in charge of a thing, right? You don't want to be an employee. The very moment that you raise equity funding, you are going to become an employee.
Yes, wow.
Maybe not at the very first moment. You might have a very amazing seed investor who says, you know, you're the visionary, run with it. But you always have to go to the next stage, right? Because that investor's looking for fast growth. That investor's looking for a future liquidity point. Therefore, you must be courting other investors. Those investors are going to want still further amounts of control. You will get still further diluted and so on. You're on track. And eventually you end up on a publicly listed board with multiple other board members holding a single digit percentage of your company, and they'll disagree with you.
Wow.
And they'll tell you what to do.
Wow. Interesting.
And it sounds like a job to me.
Wow.
And so I think a lot of people at that early stage, they don't kind of realize that they're buying themselves a job with the moment you raise money. And there's lots of opportunity these days. And again, if we're going to talk about AI, to avoid that track completely, if you wanted to.
Yes. And for sure, we should talk about it.
Truly interesting time. Yeah.
Yeah. And again, just to reference like the kind of starting point is, Even just recently, I am in Byron Bay at the moment with my family, and we had some tickets to go and watch Oasis in Melbourne, which is freaking awesome. And so we were flying down to Melbourne, and it's a trip I've done a lot over the last 2 years. And almost every single time we land in Melbourne, I'm like, how are we going to get from the airport to wherever we're going, whether it's my mother-in-law's place or to a hotel? And I've used different chauffeur companies, essentially, or transfer businesses, whatever you want to call them. So when I heard you describe the problem of J-Ride, like, oh my God, I've experienced that problem so many times. When you basically reach the end of one travel company's service or product, but it's like, well, now I don't know where the fuck I'm going next. And yes, like Uber might improve that. You could get a car directly somewhere. But even then, it's like, well, actually, now I've got 12 bags and 3 kids and 2 strollers. And do you know what I mean? It's like they're obviously more niche in terms of what you're looking for. You might have a surfboard. You might be disabled. Who knows, right? And so that problem point really echoed to me as like, what a great idea. Of course, there's a good marketplace for aggregating that step. And clearly it worked, right? You're here how many years later?
Well, I'm no longer running that company.
But the business really went, you know.
August 2023. Yeah, that's right. And so the business now continues. It's a listed enterprise. It's under new leadership, and they're doing exciting things in SaaS. I look forward to that business kind of continuing to make big runs. But the journey of being a founder there was, kind of a really interesting layup into, why Bitcoin, what it sold in capital markets, why Nostr, what it solves in go-to-markets. And there was a moment in, it was 3 years ago now. 3 years ago, I was still in J-Ride and GPT-3 came out. Do you remember how much of a splash that made?
Yeah, people were excited, yeah.
Yeah, suddenly everybody's talking about AI. And it was a really fascinating moment. So there you are, right? You're put yourself in these shoes. You're CEO, managing director, founder of a listed tech company that spent $25 million over a decade building software with the expectation that that's going to be, a technological defensibility, that no other company is going to bother to invest the same amount of money in solving the same problem because you're already there. And GPT-3 comes out and, it's, I think we all remember now in retrospect how average it was compared to current models, but GPT-3 comes out and, you can see that within a few years, you're going to be able to say, hey, model, give me a replica of J-Ride's code base. Give me a replica of ABC company's code base. And that it will go, okay, there you go.
It's done.
For broadly free and broadly instantaneously. And, that wasn't what GPT-3 was able to do, but you were able to look at it and say, how many years until that's possible? And all of that technology moat that you'd so painfully built over so many years is just, holding a residual value of zero. And how many competitors can now suddenly come and be a fast follower of your, successful model? And it was 3 years ago and I said, it's probably a decade away, but still, changes your investment horizon. You're no longer building for the eons. You're building for, I've got to make sure that this thing delivers within a 5-year span because within 10 years, I'm going to have fast followers, right? Which brings us to now, right? So I've stepped out of J-Ride and I'm doing essentially AI-led development. 6 months ago, I said, I wonder if I was wrong by 7.5 years. And I can confirm I was wrong by 7.5 years. The moment where you can sit down with a robot and say, I'd like to duplicate X and have it, not instantaneously, but pretty fast and not free, but pretty cheap, completely duplicate somebody else's business model and code. It's right now. It's possible to do today.
Wow. And the ramifications of that are just so extraordinary, aren't they? Rod, to just dwell on this for a moment, the job that you found yourself in as the founder of a business that was quote unquote your idea and your business, but suddenly you're stock listed and you've got single digits of the business, you're no longer in control. Yes, there's value that you've generated, which is great, but in some ways you're an employee, which is a fascinating insight that a lot of people won't have considered. 2023, you mentioned that the management of the business changed. How did that feel? 10 years of your life going into something and say, okay, well, maybe this isn't what I want to do with my time.
It was an interesting moment, but I wouldn't say it was a negative moment. You know, you can become too much single track on a single idea for too long. And I think I was also kind of really clear with myself that my special skills are turning nothing into something. And that's a very different game to running 150 person headcount listed entity. And I mean, a very different game. And, you know, I learned that game and that's fine. But, you know, given the opportunity to continue to run, you know, 200 person listed entity, or, you know, get my hands dirty again and get on the tools and build something that's not been seen before. I mean, that's the thing that excites me, right?
So, Rod, keep going. Where is that excitement taking you today? I think that's awesome, by the way. What a great vibe.
Yeah, it just comes back to AI. So think about just how profound this is for a second. You know, you're 10 years ago, you are a non-technical co-founder who wants to start a technology company. Okay, first step, get a technical co-founder. You need that, 50% of your equity. And then second step, go and raise a venture round for another 25% of your equity so that you can plow that money and some stock options into getting some more engineers. Okay, great. Now you've got a technical team and you're off. You get to start now. You own 30% of your company, right?
Yeah, wow.
And you go. And you go for, you know, 10 years and you end up with a single digit. Now, compare and contrast. You're a non-technical co-founder today and you go to Claude and you say, give me a prototype of X, and it just can. And you can get out the gate, you know, without the venture, without the technical co-founder even. You can get out the gate holding 100% of your company.
And very fast as well.
Yeah, but even without speed, even if you had to, you know, beat it to death over many months, you can still do it.
Yes.
And you can learn the skills as you go, and it'll teach you the skills as you go.
Wow.
And so, please
carry on.
Oh, no, I was just going to say, and so how fundamentally does that change what it means to start a technology company?
Well, it radically changes things. And to share an experience of mine, so I have tried many times to found a company and failed many times. And there's all sorts of different reasons why. But one experience I had was going through what is called talent investing. So there's some programs, one's called Entrepreneur First, another called Antler. I don't know if you've ever heard of these, but they're basically big funds that raise money on the idea that you can put two people in a room together, give them 3 months to come up with a prototype, and they're going to build the next Google. And it's like a real dragon's den, in a sense. And everyone's in there scouting each other out. It's like 100 people in the room. It's like, who do you want to work with? Who do you not want to work with? And again, as a non-technical founder, it's like, okay, I've got commercial skills. I've got industry expertise in this one specific niche, but don't really want to work in that. I need someone who can build this thing. So immediately you give them 50% away. And then, as you said, you've also got to raise the money. And so between the two of you, then selling more equity to the program that you've come through. And so the headache involved in A, getting the talent, and B, getting the funding is massive for someone who's basically an ideas man that can make something happen. You've given away more than half just to get to the point of starting. It's a massive change and affects someone like myself hugely as well.
Yeah, one of the smartest investors and wealthiest kind of investors we ever had, you know, was very straightforward that if you really think this is going to be a big and exciting company, then you should try to hold on to as much equity as you can. Right? Because why wouldn't you want to have all of the shares in this thing if it's going to be as huge as you say? Yeah, and that's obviously them being them slightly negging the investment thesis and asking for me to respond, but it is also true. And it flies in the face of what you used to read about in TechCrunch, which was fundraising round, fundraising round, fundraising round. Now, these two things can't both be true. You know, either it's important validation that you're successfully getting investors all the time, or you actually want to hold on to your company. And it's one of those, they can't both be true statements all the time. And I'm sure there's a middle ground, but I think a lot of people are attracted by the glitz and the glam of the funding. And also in an era of free money, you know, there's money, so you can get it. Go and get it. Today, you don't need it. Not only is it scarcely available, but also you don't need it. That's a kind of a radically different play. You raise your venture, you're now on a track, you know, the VC fueled hamster wheel. You're going to keep raising, you're going to keep growing, you're going to keep hiring, you're going to keep diluting. And you end up having to build a very, you know, a tiny little narrow window of valid businesses fit that mold, right? It has to be, you know, in 100 million plus, and it has to be a trade sale to a, you know, industry dominant player, or it has to be an IPO, because we as investors who are putting in the money need our liquidity. Right, where's our exit event? The little window that you get to play in becomes increasingly small. But the moment that you instead own the company, I mean, the opportunity to build different templates of business become wide open. Wide open. I mean, how much money do I truly need to happily live by the beach with my daughter and play volleyball on the beach? It's probably not, you know, a multi-hundred million dollar company, to be frank. You know, and with venture, you can't play that game. You can't decide to take, you know, 3 months off and come back to it soon. You know, these sorts of things are forbidden. They can't be done. And so, again, AI is fundamentally, I think, changing this game for founders. And what a great time to be on the outside and go after it.
Oh my God, I couldn't agree more. One small example, but something that's happened for me in just literally the last few weeks, is I had a strategy for the podcast that was incorrect. And I went 10 months, absolutely hammered it, hired an editor, hired a producer. We threw a lot of content out there, hit almost 250,000 views across all the kind of traditional platforms, which I'm really pleased with. But what I realized is that I was chasing something I didn't need to chase, and I was getting stressed about something I didn't need to be stressed about. And selling views is a commodity business. And therefore, how am I any different to someone down the road with another podcast, with another opportunity to sell a banner or a bio mention or ad reel or whatever? You're in advertising. And given the fortune I've had to invest in Bitcoin when I did, it completely shifts the playing field, because you have a deflationary savings tool that's increasing in purchasing power whilst you do nothing. And I say nothing, quote unquote, you know, homeschooling kids or whatever, but you can choose to do different things with your time than chase the funding. And so I have let Pat and Michael go. Cheers to those guys for getting me there this far. But it's like, what does AI mean for a podcaster? What does a one-man media business actually look like? And of course, this is where Nosta comes into it, because the platform risk of traditional things is huge. Like, you can just get kicked off. You can have hundreds of thousands of subscribers on YouTube, and they're like, oh, do you know what? These guys pay us more ad revenue over here, and you're talking about stuff they don't like, so you're nuked, and it's going to be some small term in the community guidelines. The point of explaining all this being, I have produced and released only one episode since this decision, and I've got one waiting in the wings to release on Friday, but I've been able to use Riverside to produce, you know, to edit, to get clips, to create captions. And I've been able to do it to the standard I want, rather than necessarily pay someone else to do it for me that does it to what they want. And I'm comfortable with how it's been. And you just think, wow, I've just probably 20x, like I've cut the cost by 20x, essentially. If I think about what the monthly running costs were and what they will be now, I'm not paying for my time. But that's a big, big, big shift in just that one tiny example as to how you can be more efficient as a solo operated business. And I call it business, quote unquote. Really what it is a creative venture that I've wrapped up as a business and got carried away. But I'd love to know, Rod, so what I love about someone like your story is you had an idea. You took it through the entrepreneurial route, you had an exit, and you're now refocusing all of that expertise to go, I'm going again. So what are some of the problems that you've stumbled across that you're like, ooh, that's something that's caught my attention, or ooh, this has caught my attention? And how do you decide where to point your energy and your skills?
So I'm running a new Nosta venture called Shosho at the moment, and I guess we'll get to talking about Shosho in a roundabout way, but the challenge that I set, I guess, challenge, the thing to validate that I set myself 6 months ago was, can you right now start a tech company with no technology people? Because, cool. Again, I 3 years ago had the view that's going to take 10 years. I thought maybe I'm wrong by 7.5 years. And so let's say you want to do that. That's your chief risk, that you're going to try and fail and that it's not possible. And in startup, the number one thing to do always is validate your riskiest assumption first. So that's the riskiest assumption. how do you then, you know, subordinate all other concerns to validating only that assumption? Well, what are the other risks when you're going into business? You know, funding risk, okay, I'll bootstrap it. Business model risk, okay, I'll copy someone else. Mm-hmm. Right? So how do you just get focused on just the development side of the problem? Can I train an AI? Well, I'm not going to do a model based. I'm not going to teach a model. I need something that's in the training data already. Okay, great. How do I build something that's going to ride on existing open source rails so that I can just feed this thing, mm-hmm. read this GitHub and tell me how it's done? All right. So I'm looking for something I can bootstrap, something with no business model risk because somebody else has already run the model successfully and it's a growth vertical. Something that's going to sit on, you know, existing training data that's already in the models and also many open source GitHub repos that I can feed it if it's missing, to narrow the playing field down, right? And then and that's where you want to play. And within that little playing field, then you can say, okay, well, now let's validate. Can the AI do its work? I'm giving it the easiest layup in the world. Can it do it? And so that's how we ended up in the playing field that is where Shosho lands. Just to pitch you Shosho for a minute, okay. Have you ever tried to sell product online, right? You go to eBay, you create a boring listing, maybe it's got a nice photo, maybe you were too busy, and you spend a lot of time writing a whole bunch of copy, and now it gets lost amongst 20,000 other people that are selling the exact same product. But you, Jake, have a podcasting platform. Right, you're an influencer. You have a social media presence. You have all of these other assets that you apparently, in traditional e-commerce, aren't allowed to bring to bear. You have to play within their little boxy shape of creating a listing. Well, no longer, because there's a new vertical, and it's called live streaming sales. And there's lovely businesses in this vertical, like Whatnot, or Shosho, or TikTok Shop. And these businesses have become an incredibly fast-growing vertical. Live streaming e-commerce. You hop on a live stream, you're here, you're on video, and you have your product. Okay, now this is for sale, guys. Sold. Okay, next product. Wow. Think about how engaging that is to be there in a live chat with everyone talking and bidding and buying together. You know, for you as a social media personality or an influencer or somebody who's just a content creator, to be able to create that content and turn your sale into a real show is something that the traditional e-commerce platforms don't do. And it's a way for you to clear vast amounts of product really quickly. Wow. In fact, that vertical in China is the fastest growing vertical in e-commerce. In 2020, wow. It went from roughly 0 to roughly 10% of e-com. They reckon when the numbers finally settle for 2024, it'll be 25% of e-com in China is going through live streaming video sales. Holy 25% shit. Of e-com in China goes through this new vertical.
That's massive.
That us in the West are completely sleeping on, besides, you know, a tiny feature in the back of TikTok that most TikTok users probably don't know. And
I'd never even heard of TikTok Shop till just then. Yeah.
Yeah, and Whatnot. I mean, they're lovely. They're growing fast. They're doing $6 billion US GMV a year, but they sell Pokemon cards. Mm. Unless you're into Pokemon cards, you probably haven't heard of Whatnot, right? So there's this vertical. It's fast growing. Business model's very well worked out. It's e-com. Mm-hmm. Right? It's the oldest business model on the internet. And what's it actually boil down to? It boils down to e-commerce shopping technology, which is, I mean, I've been doing it for 12 years, but also there's vast amounts of open source code on that, and live streaming, which is also, I mean, it's literally in the training data, right? Mm-hmm. You know, OBS was an open source foundation from the get-go. Mm-hmm. So open source training data, fast growing vertical, well worked out business model, can the AI do it? And so just from the get-go, here's Whatnot, here's TikTok, here's a whole bunch of Nosta software, here's a whole bunch of e-com software. Work out how to use that to build this. Go.
Wow.
And that's how we got started. And again, the takeaway is it can absolutely do that. Wow. It can, over the course of time, you know, again, if you're willing to spend the money on the tokens and really grind it out, it can build a feature-for-feature competitor to any business you want to point it at.
Fantastic. And so one thing that springs to mind for me is and if there's anything that Bitcoin teaches you about, it's counterparty risk. Well, there's many things it teaches you, but one major one is counterparty risk. And so having your value stored in self-custody, no one can take it from you, can't be debased on the back end. When you really understand how safe your value now is versus how it was before in a diversified portfolio of stocks and bonds with a finance manager somewhere, it completely changes your life. And I wonder with AI, and you touched on using open source, for example, is there kind of counterparty risks to building what you're creating? I.e., like, how do you actually do that? So could Grok switch you off if you were using Grok or something along those lines?
I think it's quite early still. I think there's lots of ground to cover in that landscape. Mm. You can, if you want to, run your own models. I don't. I mean, I could. You could, if you wanted to, you know, have your own hardware sitting in a rack and have your own models running on it. I guess I see enough competition to believe that the model companies aren't yet going to pull the rug on people. Mm. You know, and we're not just talking about the famous US-China competition where, you know, China wants to defeat the US's AI advantage or whatever the tabloids would say. Just the pure and simple of, you know, is it Grok or Anthropic or ChatGPT that's going to win as the best coding model and attract all of the dev income? Because we're spending a lot of money in aggregate, not much each relative to the cost of hiring an engineer, but in aggregate, I mean, there's money being spent there, and so who's going to win it? And I look at the companies and I say they're all broadly, I mean, they'll haggle at this point if you ask them, but they're all broadly interchangeable. Right. And if ChatGPT turned me off tomorrow, then I'm using someone else.
Different one. Yes,
and
yes.
I don't care. And literally the software will allow you to switch an API key and away you go. It would take me 5 minutes. So I don't know that we're going to get rugged by AI companies just yet. But even if that kind of in the future becomes a risk, I guess I imagine it's only going to become more accessible than it is now. And it's only going to become easier and easier to run your own capable, credible model on your own hardware.
On which as a builder, like the trend is your friend. And I would agree with you there completely as you lay that out. It's like, hang on, there's probably going to be more of these things. It's probably going to be more of a commodity style business as a product. You know, you're going to be competing on price against people. Yes, some of them will be more sophisticated than others. There'll be different reasons you might use one from a different one. But should you get into hot water with one particular company, well, there's going to be armies of others that you can go to. So that risk actually is very low as I think about it.
Also it comes to margin as well, if we just dwell on this for one more point, at least some of the AI apocalypse sort of stuff you hear about is, well, you know, if we're going to subordinate all thought to these computers, well, then which company are we trusting to do
this? Well, then we're in a lot of trouble.
Right. And are we actually going to end up where all surplus margin of all technology businesses in the world simply accrue to OpenAI? And again, if you ask OpenAI, their answer is absolutely, we're going to command all margin in the world. But I don't think it's true because, again, the models are broadly interchangeable with each other and clearly very imitable because look at the field of players that has cropped up in just 3 years. I would say actually that none of the AI companies will ever be able to hold on to surplus margin because they are so, I guess, so boilerplate and imitable. Mm. So where does the margin go? Right. If it's not no longer living with, you know, fat, juicy Silicon Valley companies because their technology moat has been eroded. Mm-hmm. And it also doesn't accrue to ChatGPT and clones because they're so able to copy each other. I think it goes to us as founders of small businesses and consumers who use those businesses. I think it ends up with, let's call it instead of fat company, I think you end up with fat user, which is the same premise as Nostr. Actually, yes. And the same premise of Bitcoin is that power accrues to the individual. What a wild time to live.
Yes. Oh, Rod, and what an awesome explanation. So let's unpack that a little more. The technology moat for the large, well-funded, Cantillon effect in many way businesses is actually filtering through to the user. So as the founder of a business, you can essentially be more efficient in the marketplace. So you still provide a service or a product to someone and they're willing to pay for it. But within your business, the operations can be more efficient as a result of applying AI. And so the customer gets a better deal and the founder gets a better deal. but the technology provider is actually getting slowly eroded over time because of the nature of how that technology is created.
Imagine being the CEO of a listed Silicon Valley tech co, and maybe you're DocuSign, right? You make software that signs PDFs, which Acrobat also does. You've got a $13 billion market cap somehow, and you have to turn up every quarter and say how you've defended every dollar of that and how you're going to come up with some amazing growth play to double your investors' returns over the next decade. And meanwhile, literally anyone with an LLM and 5 minutes can make a clone of your software. What do you do? Gosh. I don't think you can do anything. I think that there's a landscape within 10 years where there's 100 competitors nipping at your heels, stealing customers one by one, which you can't afford to lose because you need to continue to provide a growth outlook to your investors. How do you? You possibly can defeat one fast follower by saying, oh, I've got a bigger marketing budget, but how do you defeat an army of thousands of fast followers who are all building exact clones of your software with a few tokens in their weekend? I don't know that you can. DocuSign, $13 billion market cap. How do they defend that, right? Slack, right? Broadly speaking, Nosta does what Slack does. People will argue that it's there's more to it than that. That's fine. $26 billion market cap it was acquired by, right? These companies, how on earth are they going to, without any technology moat, defend themselves? You might say some sort of network effects. Nosta can defeat network effects. Nosta has its own network effects. I see that value is going to get distributed from these selection of just a few sanctioned, beautiful US-listed companies, distributed through thousands and millions of small businesses and entrepreneurs to the people. Because, again, starting a company like Jay and raising the money that we raised with a view we had to present that big outcome, but to start again and not raise any money and to bootstrap it, I don't need to have a company that's that big. I can be small and nimble and fast forever. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah. And it's an absolutely brilliant conversation, Rod. Thank you for sharing all of this. I have so many questions in different ways I want to take it, but let's do this. So you're building Shosho, and I want to make a shout out to Anders L., who came up with a question just on Nosta. So when can we get multi-user stream? Me and some friends want to do some live streams, podcasts on Nosta, hashtag Nosta only.
Yeah, I love the enthusiasm, eh? There's so many businesses to build here. Oh, my. Really? Yeah. And Shosho is going to be quite focused from here on out on the e-commerce part of that play because that was, again, I'm trying to make that business. But how easy is it to fork something like Zapstream and add whatever features you want to it using a model and publish it under your own brand name to achieve whatever thing that you want. And if you're not going to do it, then to put the idea out and somebody else to do it. That sort of creation becomes just so, shall we say, just accessible, right? And so whether or not Shosho ever gets to doing kind of multi-party live streaming, I don't know, I can't say, but I look at just how easy it is for anybody else to do that, and I say, it's going to happen. It's a certainty. There's a little thing in Nosta, I don't know if you've noticed it, where people these days are forking Jumble.
I haven't seen that.
Okay, so do you know Jumble?
No.
Okay, so Jumble is a Nosta client. It's a web client written by a guy named Cody. It's a beautiful web client. You should totally try it. It specializes in kind of the Twitter feed type thing. It is very focused on, and it's a Jack Dorsey quote. Make every detail perfect, limit the number of details, and then make every one of those details perfect. That's what Jumble's done for Kind One Notes. But it's open source, and Cody says, here's my code base, go for it. And people have. You fork Jumble, you tell your LLM to add a feature to Jumble, and then you publish it under your own domain. And so now you don't just have one Jumble, which has the reference implementation of how this author thinks a Kind OneNote client should be written. You're starting to have a swarm of Jumble clones where even if it just has an audience of one, me, I'm building this just for myself because I want a fancy Zap button that works like X when I press it. People are now forking that, adding that feature just for themselves and publishing it.
Wow.
So again, there'll be a landscape where you can grab your, you know, favorite live streaming client and fork it and add the thing that you want and publish it under your own name. Or grab something that already does three-party live streaming and just stick it on Ostra and publish those notes.
Wow. It's such a big shift, isn't it? Okay. And where I wanted to then go with this is a fascinating conversation I had earlier this year. I don't want to mention who it was with because I'll dox them if I do, but I was looking very closely at investing in Satlantis. And I was super impressed by some of the progress Alex made. And I previously interviewed him a couple of years back. And I really love how in just 2 to 3 years, how much people who've been building with Bitcoin behind them have improved basically in their grasp of what's going on around them and what they want to build. And I decided not to invest. And the reason was largely based on a conversation I had with a friend around return of capital rather than return on capital. And it was just like, Jake, what are the chances of you getting your money back? And I said, you know what? I actually don't know. And it was he described it as a lottery ticket for wealthy people. And it's a great description in some ways. And the conclusion I came to though was like, okay, this is a hit and hope. And you just don't quite know what's going to happen. But what's interesting is, like, first of all, the venture side of things is shifting so much. It's like, how do you as a venture investor start to justify putting money into software companies that can be replicated at the click of a button? Like the defensibility of the position you built for JRide, and equally this is what Jeff Booth talked about in his Price of Tomorrow experience as a technology founder. It's like we spent millions of dollars building this thing, and the trend was quite clearly that the cost of that production was going to zero. So how do you defend that? It's very hard. Where the conversation went was really around the moat becoming physical attributes. And so I'd love to know what your view is on this, Rod, as someone who's building a business as a non-technical founder using these off-the-shelf tools. Absolutely, the efficiency that you described is filtering through to the user and the customer, which is great. But how do you defend that position? And it got quite niche, to be honest. But I'll dig it up in a second. But let me leave that with the questions. Like, how do you start to defend yourself as a software business when you can create it as quickly as you described?
Well, the first part that I'd cover is, I think the answer to that question that you've got about lottery ticket for rich people is the portfolio approach that you issued earlier. Mm. And certainly angel investors, they don't just back one company. If you're going to do this well, you're trying to get a beta on the average return of all your companies. You're trying to hope that you back enough companies that you get the one that's going to go 100x and return the whole fund. But in order to do that, you have to back a whole bunch.
You have to place a bunch of bets.
You've got, quarter million to invest, make 10, 25,000 clips and spray and pray, right? This is not an uncommon approach to doing venture. And I think that's where a lot of venture funds have, added value, shall we say, in the past, right? Because they are the ones who actively go out and solicit the deal flow, and then you as a, an LP or whomever, you don't have time for that. And you're banking on their ability to go and find, the gems and back enough of them that one of them will hit and return the whole thing. And that, I look at that and I say, well, that's fantastic for investors, but what does it mean for founders? Because now we've got a Jeff Bezos quote, right? Here's the Jeff Bezos quote. 9 out of 10 businesses fail. I think we know that. But 1 out of 10 businesses will return 100x. And so if you can play that bet, you'd play it every day of the week, right? Because 9, 10 in the trash, but 1 becomes 100, go again. Where you can see how if you're playing the odds that way, it compounds. And, your typical early stage venture investor has been doing that forever. But it's never been possible for a founder to do so because nobody has time in their life to go 10 times. Right? Look, I mean, I've just come out of a business that took me 10 years. Right? And again, what's changed in the realm of AI? Start a business, launch it, took 6 months. I could do that 10 times. Right. If I didn't get sufficient traction to be excited to continue with Show Show, which I mean, I'm getting some interesting traction. It looks exciting. Let's continue. I mean, park it, do another, park it, do another. And every time you do one, your AI practice gets faster. Every time you do one, you know, you probably build a useful, reusable code base, especially if you're building on something that's open source, like a Nostr. Right. So suddenly you, as you know, following that, you know, 9 out of 10 fail, you get to go 10 times. And so this opportunity to make sure that you eventually get a hit, which was always reserved in the past for the investor class, is now starting to accrue to the founder class.
Really cool.
And so how do you, then to loop back to your question, how do you defend that? Well, you just get ready to go 10 times. Mm. I think at the highest level, let's assume that we're right. And, you know, all value is about to accrue to users who can spin up exact copies of your, you know, company and run it for themselves for, you know, pennies with their own LLM. And even the LLM doesn't make margin on that. And all margin accrues to the user. And let's imagine that beautiful future and that we're heading there. That's great. But I still think that we've maybe got a window right now of, let's call it 5 to 10 years, where we're actually just going to go and steal Silicon Valley's cheese.
Mm. Mm. Well, and also it's like, you know, how many people have even got an AI app on their phone? Look at global internet adoption. Some people aren't even online in some countries. You know, just it's extraordinary in terms of the macro setup to think about. Okay, if you're basically faster to market with AI than other people, there's an opportunity. There's no doubt about that. And what a cool insight. So yes, so as a founder, you just get ready to hit it 10 times. So I was thinking it's like the execution risk is lower. Because if it fails, it doesn't matter. It hasn't taken as long. You just try another one. Would that make sense? Yeah, interesting. Okay. And so where we went with the, again, to reference this conversation I had was like, okay, but what if defensibility is not just an iteration speed like you describe, or the opportunity to be like a first mover with AI, but what if the opportunity to defend was actually around real world physical assets and competencies, and looking at, okay, well, it's actually quite difficult to fulfill the creation of a house, for example. What about applying AI to house building or a boring business like laundry? Like, people still need to get their laundry done. Okay, what if you're faster into that business? And I found that quite compelling as a investor, at least, because it's like, these are services that people are going to need ongoing. And you've also got this class of boomers that are retiring and selling businesses, and maybe you could take one of those on. Now, I didn't do any of those things, very much just like spitballing ideas around. But to put a cherry on this idea of defensibility then, Rod, so in your opinion, it's about speed as a founder.
As a founder, your defensibility will be, I think, in the practice that you build around getting up and going and getting up and going. Mm-hmm. I think your speed to market is part of it, but also just, you know, your reusable methods and processes. The thing that separates, you know, AI-based users who are using Base 44 or, you know, some sort of rapid prototyping tool that have no experience and skills, but they're getting something out the door right now. The thing that separates them from those who are going to actually win is not the model, because everyone's got the same model. It's the process. Mm. Right? It's how do you build your dev practice so that you have the process that runs faster and more repeatably and more confidently than anyone else? This is not a new idea. Rocket Internet, this was their idea, right? Take no business model risk, right? Copy an existing business model. Choose a market where it doesn't exist, right? Hire, you know, have a process for all of these things. Hire a absolute go-getter in that market and say, here's your funding and here's your business model and I want you to do exactly this. Mm. And then repeat that as often as you can with as many verticals as you can and as many countries as you can, using, you know, their little repertoire of which businesses are worth copying, which markets are worth entering, and how do you hire the right founder for each of those businesses. And that's their little repeatable process. And they just ran it. And this is how Rocket Internet created, I can't even name how many beautiful companies.
Yeah.
I see that happening again here, right? Because if you build your AI dev process, right, and you work out the little things that make you and your team go at impeccable speed with repeatable confidence. And it doesn't matter how many businesses models you want to attack before you find a hit, because you know for sure you will find one. Is kind of how I'm starting to think about it. And again, I'm quite impressed by the traction of Shosho, but the very moment that I find something more exciting, I know that I'll be able to go get it. Is a wild landscape for a founder to be in. It's not the landscape I was in with JRide, where I was, you know, beholden to investors whom I'd raised money that I had to keep going. It's a very different landscape. And I just think that's the landscape that exists for founders now.
But it strikes me then that essentially the quest for product market fit can now be funded by your time, and elongates the process such that the chance of success is better. And you can also hustle different ideas at the same time, because the engine room of developing those ideas is a piece of software that you've got and a process. I mean, it's absolutely insane for any entrepreneur, basically. Like, what a time to be building stuff. Like, holy shit.
Yeah, what a time. What a time to be on the outside. And only on the outside. I mean, Big Co can't do what I'm describing, right? Have you ever seen a Big Co trying to spin up an innovation lab and succeed?
No,
never. It's the rarest thing in the world. Put your hat on for a minute and go back to Big Co and think about how they're responding to this. Your board of directors just asked you whether or not you're leveraging AI to, you know, reduce cost base and improve efficiency. And so you go to your head of customer service and you say, you know, hey, you repeat the question. Are you doing X, Y, Z? Give me a plan on my desk tomorrow that, you know, tells me the opportunity that you haven't captured yet and how you're going to go and get it. What's your head of customer service going to do? Is they look around and they see their budget and they think, oh, that's going to get cut. And then they see their headcount and they say, oh, I love these people and I spent so long recruiting them. And then they say, oh, you know, but I've got an existing customer base. And what if I upset them with bad AI replies? And we've got this existing brand reputation. And what happens if we damage it? And we can't stand those risks. That would be horrible. We're not going to be able to say with a straight face that AI is any good. And besides that, if I did say with a straight face that AI was good, I'm going to lose budget next quarter. I'll just say that, you know, we explored it and it's not good. Right. And so then you go back to your board of directors and you say, oh, well, you know, it's the opinion of our senior leadership team that there's nothing to do here and we should just keep on with our business. Compare and contrast to you, Jake, the outsider, who looks at an incumbent company and says, I wonder if I can copy that with no one at all. Mm. Right. I wonder if I can go after that and instead of having 600 headcount, have 2. Mm. You might be wrong. It might not be possible. But if you fail, you've lost nothing. And if you succeed, you win the whole game because they can't come after you. And you can only go, and you can only do that if you're on the outside. So I mean, what a time to be a founder. I really think so.
Rod, do you think then, I've heard some others talk about this, but conceptually, do you think a single man billion-dollar business is possible?
Oh, I mean, sure.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, I wonder if eventually you'll get companies that are running so much on autopilot that maybe the founder passes away and no one notices. and the AIs just keep collecting Bitcoin every day, and eventually it's, you know, one of the largest holders and there's no one running it at all, but also no one knows how to turn it off or even where the software runs. All sorts of things are going to happen.
Wow. It's extraordinary, isn't it? Oh my gosh. Rod, what I want to do is I want to circle back to something you touched on very near the start of the conversation, and that was around policy and this experience you had building a business in travel, and first of all, like what it was like to be close to the money printer in a sense, and also then the idea that, like, oh, look, here's this pandemic that's come along and your market's now just closed. At least those are the two things that I think that you were referencing when you talked about policy. So what does that mean to you, and what were some of your lessons from that?
Yeah, so just to unpack a little bit about what happened there. So running a travel technology business into the onset of the pandemic. And most investors start calling around January of 2020 saying,
what's going on?
Is something happening? Do you see anything in your numbers? And at that time, we didn't. Right? We had one investor call and say, prepare. Okay, well, we'll take that in mind and we're watching it carefully. Then March 2020, US closes its borders and the whole world rapidly follows suits, and immediately, you know, your travel technology company that hasn't had a single down quarter in, oh, what was it at that point, 10 years or 9 years, suddenly loses 95% of its revenue immediately and has to refund $10 million worth of travel repairs that aren't going to go ahead, and also still work out how to pay transport companies for all the jobs that they did do. What a crazy trip. Oh, and also explain that to the team and explain that to the capital markets. Wow. While, you know, planning the, I guess, you know, unwinding of 75% of your headcount. You know, what a thing. And, you know, you can look at that and you can say it was a virus, but I'm not responding, when I'm responding to that, I'm not responding to a virus, I'm responding to a policy decision. Hmm. I'm responding to the US and then subsequently Australia's decision to close borders and say that travel is no longer a vertical we want to support. Hmm. Yeah. And so, you know, what do you do? Well, I mean, you get through it, right? So you manage the team through it. You tell them all to work from home. You know, have emergency board meetings. You reduce costs. You get through on the smell of an oily rag. And if you do it well, you know, take care of your people. And then, you know, at that future point in late 2021, when we were able to, you know, be an exciting barbell story and raise a bunch of money, you're able to bring those people who are still on the outside, you know, back from whatever job they managed to land that they didn't prefer, because, you know, you took care of them. Now you're hiring again, they'll come back to you. And we did all of that, and we did it very well. And still, it makes you look at the situation and say, you know, and again, as a founder, you're into only one business, right? Bolt of lightning out of a blue sky, suddenly everything shuts down for that one business. You know, what if I had two businesses and one of them was Zoom?
Mm.
Right. And oh, look, travel's done, but wow, look at teleconferencing. And you just not just pull your own focus, but pull your capital and pull your team and go and scale your other business up. So, you know, this is a thing that investors were doing when they were diversifying against multiple verticals that founders couldn't and now maybe can. And so, you know, again, sitting through that experience with Jayride and you're seeing the impact of these massive external macro forces and how they will absolutely crush you without any thought. And kind of maybe, you know, I guess if you're a Bitcoiner and you have a view to monetary policy being insane, and you maybe perceive that, you know, the state response to that fallacy of monetary policy will be continued insanity, possibly with greater severity, possibly with greater frequency in future years, from whatever form it might take, you say, well, diversification. let's run multiple parallel entrepreneurial tracks if we can, or at least build a core competency of skills and discipline around starting things, so that if, let's call it maybe not inevitable, but if catastrophic macro forces affect you again, you can say, I'm going from here to here, or you can say, okay, take this competency of starting something and start something that's appropriate for the time and space. Mm-hmm. Put the other thing just on ice for a minute and come back to it when it's ready. You know, that's the sort of thing you didn't have the flexibility to do as a listco. You know, it was my job to help investors through it, to make sure the company remained funded, to take care of all suppliers and team members and so on and so forth. And so, you know, you step into the role and you do your job. But given the choice, better to be on the outside.
Yeah, it's very interesting, isn't it? And so the bolt from the blue, what do you think, and you touched on this just now, it's essentially you want diversification as a founder, which is now in theory possible to do, given the engine room of the business can be automated, essentially. What were some of the decisions you've made over the last 6 to 12 months of building that have been heavily influenced by that experience?
I lost your question, Jack. Sorry, can you feed it to me again?
Over the last 6 to 12 months of building, which decisions have you made that have been a result of the insight around the fact that you can have diversification as a founder?
I mean, getting into Nostr.
Yeah.
Cool. 100%. I mean, I think you asked about, you know, at the very start, and you wanted to focus, I think, a little bit on why the choice.
Yeah, let's get there. And, 60 minutes later, great.
It's okay. Because I already gave you the layup that at least part of this is about feeding the AI and just the sheer mass of beautiful open source code that's been funded and made available for people to build on the network, and just how fast that makes your speed to market with AI, because you can feed it existing great architecture and say emulate, and it will, right? But also diversification, right? So I have a particular lens to this, which I like to roll out. Do you remember a thing called Google Wave?
No.
A little while ago. And you know Google Maps. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So Lars, who founded Google Maps, it wasn't called Google Maps. It got acquired by Google, Lars with it. Lars was given a remit at Google to make something revolutionary, right? It was going to be a brand new communication platform that replaced email, forums. It had, you know, multi-party editing in real time, which, you know, later then moved into Google Docs. It had all of these fundamental innovations. He ran that for 3 years. He made a big deal out of this in the developer and founder community, because the vision was, let's create a platform where everybody can get onto it. Everyone can build their own applications. This is going to provide like a fundamental layer that is otherwise missing. And it's going to be Google, but it's going to be open so that other people can build on it. Let's get out there. Let's get the developers in there and building on this thing. And he had 3 years, and then, you know, the CEO of Google just said, no, too complicated, pulled the plug. I happened to meet him in a bar because he was Sydney based, happened to meet him in a bar shortly after that happened. And I was such a dickhead. I asked the question, you know, what happened? And he had certain commitments that he was going to be able to take a long path to make a proper infrastructure play for the development community that he believes weren't fulfilled. And he went off to Facebook, and I presume he was very happy there. But the lesson is, you know, he is one of the biggest and most exciting technology firms in the world, making a promise to the development community. Here's a platform that you can use to build your business on. And then 3 years later, they pull the plug and pull the rug out from every one of those developers, and everyone who built on Google Wave then is left going, well, look at all the time and the capital we wasted, right? What a complete waste of time. I wish I had done anything else, right? I just had the rug pulled entirely. It's the deplatforming thing that you talked about, but writ large across, you know, what was supposed to be this innovative new thing. Lesson learned, you know, don't invest on building on somebody else's land. You know, do build only on something that you can own. And so along comes Noster with a statement that, you know, you can own this. There's no central anything. There's no one who controls it enough to pull the rug. You can continue to write JSON in this format forever, and absolutely nobody could stop you, even if they wanted to. That's a better foundation to be building on, right? It's platform, deplatformless risk, none of that risk. Bad English, but you take my point. Think about like how the internet started, right? So, you know, here's an open protocol. It's protocols that make the internet great. Here's an open protocol for communication of information, HTTP. It's brand new. We're going to have publishers who own websites, who publish data, and then we're going to have users who visit websites to consume data. But that's not actually, you go forward these days, that's not actually how we use the internet, right? Every single user of the internet is both a creator and a consumer. How many of us own websites and servers? Few, if any, right? But that's not even the main way that we want to do it. We want to be, as an individual, networking with our social network, consuming their content, creating content in reply to them, right? Like, it's an entirely different use from the original kind of web one. Now, the market, as it does, sorted that out by saying, well, you know, I'm, you know, Mark Zuckerberg, and I say that wouldn't it be great if users could exist within a social graph and create and consume content from each other? And venture investors said, you're right, that is missing from the protocol. Let's create a company out of that, and we'll put a lovely moat around it, and we'll try to protect it, and we'll build shareholder value. Hang on. That's not why the internet was created, right? The building of moats around data interoperability to build shareholder value was not why the internet was created, right? The internet was created for interoperability, right? For permissionlessness, but it was missing that social layer. Facebook created it and put a wall around it. Google tried and they cried many times, and one of them was called Wave and they rugged everyone. You know, what I see with Nostr is I see, well, here's the missing piece of the protocol, right? Here's a thin, very simple identity layer, interoperability protocol, very basic content distribution that anyone can copy, anyone can emulate, anyone can build on, that can't be taken away. You don't need to ask anyone's permission to use it. That's the internet. And so, again, thinking about, like, as a founder, am I going to go and apply for permission from large Silicon Valley juggernaut, or am I just going to build on something that's open Rails? 100% open Rails. And this then, again, come to being a founder. You know, can I still remove more risk? What risks am I removing by going here? One, I'm removing deplatforming risk. You mentioned
massive.
That. Right? And not just because I've said something, you know, mean and now the company doesn't want my custom anymore, but also, as in the Google Wave example, companies shut platforms down all the time. Right? So I'm removing those risks, right? I'm also increasing all sorts of opportunity, because anyone can be building on the same rails and I can interoperate with those contents. Think about the speed to market, right? Think about all the things you just don't have to build, right? So we've launched Shosho. It provides live streaming. I didn't have to build a sign-up page. I just said, plug in your Nostr ID. I didn't have to build an edit profile page. I didn't have to decide on any architecture because I just copied the standard. I didn't even have a server. I just...
Yeah. Do you want to invite your friends? No.
Yeah, exactly. And then the big one, here's a you know, peer-to-peer sort of experience where I don't have to solve a chicken and egg problem. I don't have to worry where my first users and content are going to come from, because I just bring it in from the network. It's already there. And so you get this massive advantage with less risk and faster time to market. I mean, everyone should build on Nostr. I don't see there's any better way.
Yeah, I like to think of it as a superior form of capital allocation. And it's largely because it's the property rights. It's built different. And protocol is superior to platform. And saying, you know, like a Rumble, we won't switch you off. Okay, until you do. Or Elon, like, I've just bought the whole of Twitter because I can, and now I'm going to run it as a business and it has to make money. And if it doesn't, then I'm fucked. Oh, well, guess what? I'm going to call it the free speech platform, but actually there's a whole lot of stuff we're doing on the back end that means that it's not. And that's a choice, and that's absolutely their choice, because they're private businesses. You can do whatever you like. But until you understand that, and I think it's that whole thing, it's like basically the internet's become, oh, I'm going to hop on Instagram for a bit and now I'm going to go to YouTube. Oh, maybe I'm going to hang out on TikTok for a little bit, or TikTok shop, and now I'm at Amazon and now I'm done. It's like, that's like a bunch of private companies with digital monopolies that either monetize your attention or are a classic kind of e-commerce play and are winning because of the tendencies of a monopoly. And it's funny, really, like the deeper you get into this concept of the free market, it's like, that's okay. It's do whatever you like. But as individual entrepreneurs or creators, this is the playing field. And if you just so happen to see that the playing field is over here as well, aka Nostr, and you can have a key pair that, you know, I even got excited recently thinking about inheritance. And I'd read a great book that was called Call Me Ted, which is about a guy called Ted Turner who started CNN. And he inherited a business from him for his father in the US that was an advertising company with billboards. And it was like the 50s and people were driving cars and suddenly the billboard business was growing. And that turned into what became CNN. And it's an amazing story, just because you're like, the playing field was different. Billboards and cars were a big deal. But now it's like, we're in cyberspace. And currently your billboard is on Facebook's digital real estate or on Google's digital real estate. And so if they want to just burn your billboard down, they could. But Nostr changes that. And you're like, wow, what would it be like to inherit a Nostr key pair in 30 years' time that's been building or accruing capital all that period? I don't know what that looks like, but it's like, wow, the playing field's just changed.
Yeah, look, I agree. It's a different playing field. It's a great time to be a founder. your ability to get out the door and build a thing with AI, your ability to build on an open platform where no one can ever rug you, your ability to diversify, right, avoid risks, and I guess even more than anything else, go and target overblown, fat, too high market cap Silicon Valley companies that no longer have technology moats and possibly no longer even have network effect moats, should Nostr succeed, and just go and take their business. And ultimately, then over the course of 5 to 10 years, through enough entrepreneurs doing that, create a world of empowered users, you know, Bitcoiners would say sovereign individuals. Well, I mean, what a time. It's a great place.
Yeah, and I think it's this idea, isn't it, that the you control your own data, and without necessarily realizing it, when you log into Twitter with your email and your password or whatever might be the case, you're stepping onto someone else's piece of private property, and that's okay because they built it and someone owns it. But what that means is, if you're quote unquote free, like, you're the product. And somehow that's just, people don't even realize, right? Oh, they've got an Instagram account. Like, do you understand what you've given away in order to actually have that? Like, what's the cost? And in some ways, it takes an innovation like Nostr to turn up for you to really be able to answer that question more effectively, because it's shifted. And so, okay, Rod, we've been going for an hour or so. I'll look to wrap this up in the next 5 minutes. I'm intrigued just to get a bit of a futuristic play. You know, we've talked a lot about like what you're doing right now, but over the next kind of 12 to 18 months, what's got you most excited, and where are you going to spend your time?
I'm excited about Nostr generally. And then specifically, I think live streaming is a very exciting vertical plan. I'm going to build that live streaming e-commerce play in Shosho that I've mentioned, but just live streaming in general. I think we've seen over the last little bit, social media protocols, and it doesn't matter, protocols or businesses, it doesn't matter which they are. The moment they add live streaming, it's a very important and interesting thing for them to add that's additive. We've seen, for example, Rumble add it and suddenly get a lot of traction. We've also seen some of the incumbents like Twitch lose a bunch of market share to Kick. Streaming is becoming decentralized. Streaming always had this really interesting opportunity, right? It's all open source code. It's all open source Legos, just like Nostr, where anybody can plug and play little bits together and go live. But it had a key problem, which was discoverability, right? It doesn't age well, this content. Unless you're there live at the moment, unless you can be found at the moment, then your live stream expires and it's gone. And, so you need to find a way to get discovered. Traditionally, a few large platforms, be it Twitch or YouTube or, TikTok, became these centralized discoverability portals. But, Nostr solves discoverability, right? If not in full now, as it's new in time, it has its own network effect. And then you, as a streamer, can publish to any server, have that syndicated through any relay to any consumer on any website. Must be ultimately better discoverability than I can only stream to one server and it can only be on one website, surely. And so I see, in general, streaming is a very interesting market that's already breaking apart and decentralizing, and I see Nostr as really interesting rails for that to ride on. I must give props to Kieran, right, for showing the way with Zapstream, but then as kind of more people enter this, you're going to see different servers, you're going to see different, broadcasters, you're going to see all sorts of different things come through, different business models, like I'm talking about with Shosho and others, like maybe TK building with his, Apple TV for Nostr streaming app. Is any number of things that can happen here. So I'm really watching that closely. I'm pretty excited to see where it goes.
Awesome. And I'm very excited to see what you create, Rod. It's a conversation like this is such a great kind of snapshot for a moment in time, and in a year or 2 years you can go back and you listen to, oh, that's what we were talking about then, and this has then happened or whatever. And what's so cool is someone with your skill set essentially refocusing their attention in this direction, going, okay, well look, I built a company before, I know what I'm doing in this sense. You've just talked through the Rocket Internet playbook, but we can do that as individuals. You don't need to be Rocket Internet to do that any longer. Oh, very, very exciting. Well, Rod, thank you so much. And the final comment would be, it would be interesting to live stream some of these conversations. And so I haven't done this before with Nostr, Because I haven't figured it out yet, but you could live stream conversations that then obviously become recorded podcasts. And it's a very popular thing to do. Maybe that's, I'll have a play around looking at some of the different tools to do that and see where that takes me the next couple of weeks. But Rod, thank you so much for your time today. Last question, if people want to reach out, what's the best way to do that?
Find me on Nostr. Jake, can you share my handle?
Absolutely. I'll put it in the show notes. Well, Rod, thanks so much for your time today.
Thanks, Jack. It's been a pleasure.
Cheers. Thank you.